On today's episode, the DNA evidence that puts women at the heart of Bronze Age society.
The mathematician on Guernsey who accidentally unlocked the secrets of a prehistoric burial chamber.
And Lawrence Shaw tells you all you need to know about Time Team's next excavation in Northumberland.
Yes, hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams. And just before we get into this week's episode, I want to draw your attention to next week because it's a really interesting one, actually. We're speaking to Professor Ken Dark. Now, he is the director of the Tintagel Hinterland Project, and he's just written a book all about Tintagel Castle in Cornwall and its links to King Arthur, and how understanding it a little bit more deeply can give us an amazing insight into that period that I'm really interested in at the moment, which is that period between Roman and post-Roman Britain.
Tintagel is one of the few places that both feature in the legends and have good archaeological evidence for life at the relevant time. Now, it's attracted many of what you might call the more unusual and eccentric archaeologists over the last century or two, and so the debate around what you can discover and what you can't is still raging.
That is next week, then. Today, you're going to hear, as I said, from Lawrence Shaw about our next X-Crew dig. You'll meet the Guernsey finance expert who's used maths to reveal the secrets of a prehistoric burial chamber, and you'll learn about new DNA evidence which could change our understanding of Bronze Age society.
First, though, last week we told you how a limited number of Time Team members have the opportunity to join us on an excavation in October. Here to tell you more is Time Team's Carenza Lewis. Hello, Carenza.
Hi, Helen.
This is such an exciting opportunity. What can you tell us about the dig?
Yeah, it is a really exciting opportunity. So we're going to be looking for an important medieval site, and it's within the amazing historic city of Lincoln, which was one of the most important cities in medieval Britain. And the site we're going to be investigating is not very well known. So anything we find out about it will be a real advance of knowledge. I know that all our volunteers will be absolutely fascinated by the story of this site and what we can discover about it, which will really transform our knowledge.
Oh, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, isn't it, for our Time Team members? So, so exciting. What will people, if they are successful in their application, they do get to volunteer with Time Team, what will they be doing? What will they be able to do, getting their hands dirty?
So we're going to be needing volunteers to help with a whole load of different roles. So whatever volunteers' abilities and interests, there'll be something there for them. We'll be doing work in archaeological trenches, so there will be a couple of opportunities to work in the trenches. We'll also be doing test pitting around the site to see what sort of finds turn up further away and how those compare with those at the centre of the site. And of course, we'll need volunteers to help with pot washing, with finds processing, and, you know, sometimes even just marshalling, guiding people around the site, visitors. We expect to have a lot of visitors. So there'll be something for everybody to do.
So how do people go about applying? What do they have to do?
Well, volunteers have to be fully paid up members of Patreon, but all the details will be available on Patreon very shortly. So now's the time to sign up so you don't miss out on the opportunity. We want to get as many volunteers involved as possible, but inevitably there is a limited number of places. So the sooner people get signed up and registered, the better. It's also worth, I wanted to make sure people know that it's taking place in Lincoln. If anyone who does get a chance to come along and volunteer, I'd really recommend they book an extra couple of days accommodation and give themselves a treat of a little visit round Lincoln. It's an amazing historic city. It's got standing Roman ruins. It's got standing stone buildings from the 12th century, just a generation after the Norman conquest and the Bayeux Tapestry. We actually have standing stone buildings. It's got an amazing medieval castle, a stunning cathedral that was the tallest building in the world for 200 years
wow.
in the medieval period. So taking part on the Time Team dig could be a really fun bit of a sort of extended stay, really immersing yourself in medieval history. Having dug it up, you can then look at it all around you.
Being able to stand actually underneath the arch of a Roman city gate, like you can do at Lincoln, it's an unforgettable experience.
It certainly is, yeah. There's a real sense in Somewhere Lincoln that the archaeology is above you, around you and below you, sort of everywhere you go. But it's a rare opportunity to actually get to dig some of it up yourselves, and especially on a site where there's so little known about its condition, about its layout, about how it was used. It's an amazing opportunity.
Isn't it just? Well, thank you, Carenza, so much for giving us a little bit extra, little few more details about it. I know there's so much that you can't say as well that you really want to, and we'll get to all those details.
Well, I'll come back later on the programme when we know more about it, and when we can announce more about it and can tell people a bit more. But in the meantime, I'd just say, as soon as you're accepted, start looking at accommodation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that application form is going to be going live on Patreon as soon as we can possibly bring it to you. So if you are a Time Team member, head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial and keep an eye out for it there. And hopefully we'll see you on site in October.
A few months ago, we were getting very excited about the results of some DNA analysis that had been carried out on the remains of two children who were buried together at our so-called princely burial site at Cherrington in the Cotswolds. Now, the results showed the girl and boy in the grave were brother and sister, and we talked at the time about how much potential new DNA techniques have for giving us a greater understanding of the past.
Now, a new DNA discovery is changing what we thought we knew, and this time it relates to Bronze Age bones discovered over 200 years ago near Stonehenge. Stout Man, as he was known, is actually a woman.
Yes, and knowing that could change our understanding of the role of women in Bronze Age society. Let's bring in David Dawson now. He's the director of Wiltshire Museum, where Stout Man, or should that now be Stout Woman, has been on display. And we've also got Tom Booth of the Crick Institute, who led the DNA research. Hello, both of you.
Hello.
Hi.
How shocked were you then? And maybe, David, I can start with you. How shocked were you to find out the results then of that DNA analysis?
Well, absolutely gobsmacked, because the skeleton was dug up first in 1803, and as you say, described as a stout man. But in 2000, the site was re-excavated and the skeleton was recovered. And we sort of assumed, of course, that it was male. And so to hear that it was female was just a complete and utter surprise, came completely out of the blue. But we have Tom to thank for that.
Yeah, so the skeleton was actually reburied. It was William Cunnington who excavated the skeleton originally. And back then, they didn't tend to keep hold of the skeletons like we do now. Partly it seems to be because they didn't really think they were very useful for anything. So after the skeleton was dug up in 1803, it was reburied back in the barrow. And then Colin Shell and Jill Swanton, associated with Cambridge University, went back and re-excavated it because the barrow is slowly being eroded away to try and save the human remains, some sort of further erosion, and investigate the human remains themselves. And they re-excavated Cunnington's pit and found the skeleton. And then they got in contact with us at the Crick Institute for the DNA analysis. We sampled initially the petrous portion of the temporal bone, which is this bone that surrounds your ear. And that's where DNA tends to be best preserved. So we sampled that. The genetic sex result is one of the first results that we get back, because it's very simple to do. Essentially, it's defined by whether you have a XY chromosomes, which is typically male, or XX chromosomes, which is typically female. So immediately it came back as XX, which was exciting to me because I knew the history of the skeleton as well, and so assumed that it was going to come back as totally male.
Yes, because the contents of the grave are quite remarkable, aren't they, David? The grave is sometimes described as the grave of a shaman, sometimes a metal worker or a gold worker. It's a really unusual grave.
It is, and she's both. She's both a shaman and a metalworker. A shaman, of course, sort of ritual specialist or priest, if you like. And she's called that because she's wearing a necklace made of animal bones, and animal bones around the bottom of a cloak as well. So it was sort of a ceremonial costume. But then she had an amazing array of objects which relate to her work as a metalworker, sort of a whole set of tools, including battle axes that have been used for working gold. So it's just extraordinary burial.
So how does it change our understanding of Bronze Age society? Because I have to admit, I don't know how much DNA analysis has been done on burials. I don't know how many individuals we've got that we can actually sex at all. Are we still labouring under those kind of fog of ignorance and thinking tools equals men and jewellery equals women? Is this the first one, or are we beginning to see it popping up in other places in the Bronze Age?
I think it probably will pop up in other places. Because, first of all, human osteology sexing techniques, while they're relatively accurate, they're not always correct. Of course, the biggest thing that genetic testing of sex has an impact on is children, because osteological techniques can't sex children, because most of the bony changes that occur that are diagnostic of males and females happen after puberty. What ancient DNA gives us is a way of sexing children and infants for the first time in a reliable way. That adds a different dimension to how we investigate not just Bronze Age graves, but graves across history and prehistory that are assumed to be a particular sex because of the grave goods that they're in, but has never really been confirmed because they're the graves of children.
And why do you think it was assumed that stout woman was actually stout man? Is it just a simple case of, oh, well, they were probably a metal worker, so it must have been a man? Or were there more sort of less sexist, more legitimate reasons why you might have assumed it was a man?
Yeah, in sort of slight defense of William Cunnington, when we did do an osteological assessment of the skeleton as well, it was one of these skeletons that falls in the gaps. It was indeterminate. It had a mixture of male and female characteristics. We also, from the bones, got an estimated age of death, and that was 45. Sexing skeletons becomes more unreliable the older the person gets. So I suspect, again, in Cunnington's defense, that this was quite a masculine-looking skeleton because it was from a postmenopausal female who'd gone through hormonal changes, which had affected her skeleton and made it look slightly more masculine, as well as potentially her, you know, lifetime of activity as well, working metal. So one of the other things that was found osteologically was that they had osteoarthritic changes in their right wrist, but not in their other wrist, which suggested that they were right-handed and is sort of consistent with this lifetime of using metalworking tools.
Can I come to Cunnington's defence from another perspective, which, of course, in 1803, they were not looking for those differences in the male and female skeleton. He was going on the size and the robustness of the bones, and he was not a medical man. It was not for 100 years before people started really thinking about whether the skeletons were male or female or not.
I think you're absolutely right there, David. You raise a kind of interesting question about what we can know. Up until the advent of DNA analysis like this, we've just not been asking those questions, have we? Like, what was the difference in the way that the male sphere and the female sphere in the Bronze Age? Because they were pointless questions because you couldn't answer them. We've often used a kind of ungendered worldview, which has tended to mean that we use the modern kind of rather sexist mindset. We just assume that metal workers are male and so on, because in inverted commas, we will never know. This is not exactly changing our view, is it? It's opening up a whole new area that we can look at that we've never been able to look at before. So it does seem to me to be really exciting. Do you agree?
Absolutely. And it does open up completely new vistas. And there was also other techniques that are starting to come through as well, like looking at fingerprints. And it's becoming clear that many potters were female. It does remind us to question those assumptions we have. Also, we could do a whole different podcast on this tool she was buried with. She was buried with objects that were clearly heirlooms, up to 1,000 years old when buried with her, that she was using. And so that toolkit has a fantastic story to tell, with amazing research done by Rachel Krellin at the University of Leicester.
Yeah, I think that would be an absolutely fascinating thing to talk about another time. So thank you so much, David and Tom, for coming on and showing what we can get out of all these new techniques. It just opens up so many new horizons. It's very exciting, and I hope we can talk to you again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams. And a reminder, by the way, if you want more from Time Team, including exclusive Dig Watch episodes that take you right to the heart of a dig day by day as it's happening, there's behind the scenes videos as well, masterclasses, we've got 3D models, plus ad-free and bonus episodes of this podcast, then becoming a Time Team member, I reckon, is the thing for you. There's new content being released all the time, plus there's a huge archive to enjoy as well whenever you want. You head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial to find out more, and supporting us there funds the archaeology we do and the programmes we make.
Speaking of Time Team archaeology, let's get you up to speed with our next dig, which is happening very soon indeed. Our expedition crew, a small, slimmed-down team of archaeologists, are making the difficult journey to a site in Northumberland, and Lawrence Shaw is here to tell you what you have to look forward to.
Lawrence, hello.
Good afternoon, good morning, whatever time it is for you in the world today. How are you both doing? All right.
Very, very well, thank you. And as usual, getting excited for your next expedition. I mean, regular listeners to this podcast, I think, will maybe remember that you and Stuart went to do a recce of the site a little while ago. But just remind us, where exactly are you going? What are you doing?
We are heading to a little deserted medieval site called Culler Clough, which is at Keilor Head in Northumberland. It is in the middle of nowhere. If you stand on the site, you can see the Scottish borders on one side, and on the other way, you look inland towards England. So beautifully remote and very, very interesting.
So what are you hoping to find out? What are the questions?
The question. So Culler Clough, this is, I call it a deserted medieval village, but this is a settlement in the form that there are earthworks of buildings surviving on in this little valley next to a stream. But with regards to the archaeology in these types of areas, they're very poorly investigated because they're so difficult to get to. You need a proper organisation like Forestry England, who we're teaming up for this with, to be able to get to the site, to get the resources, to really be able to get to grips with these archaeological remains properly. Because it's, and to give you context, it's going to be a 20-minute drive down some forest tracks and then a half an hour to 45-minute hike across the valley to get to our archaeological site. So that gives you an idea as to why these sites are so poorly investigated previously. So this is an opportunity that doesn't come up every day, but it's an opportunity to go and look at a site and a time period in a region that hasn't really been looked at in any great depth previously before. So we've got this deserted settlement. We want to understand its age, its purpose, its function, and try and understand a little bit more about the time period as well. This is a time of reaving or reavers. So there's raiders coming over from Scotland. There's raiders going back the other way. There are shealing sites with like temporary little farmsteads in and around the region. So it's very nomadic sort of, I want to say intertidal, that's probably the wrong word, but sort of the interface between different nations and also civilization as we might know it in terms of towns and things. It's a lot more rural, it's a lot more disconnected. And how are these people living?
Stuart, of course, came on the recce and was walking around doing his usual Stuart Ainsworth thing of looking at the lumps and bumps. What was he able to tell you about that site and some of the archaeology you might be able to get out of it?
Everyone needs a Stuart in their back pocket, don't they, really, for these things. And it was great to have him there. And he'll be joining us on the dig. But just unpicking the composition of the site, and I think one of the really interesting things is the scalability, because we are going to be looking at a particular building within a series of buildings. But then Stuart's looking at the larger infrastructure. He's identified a lazy bed. He's identified a larger enclosure that surrounds the settlement, sort of giving us that spatial spread from individuals in one house to the settlement, to the enclosure, to the functions around crop production, but also identifying field systems outside of the enclosure as well. So understanding how they're using the landscape and potentially prior to this settlement arriving as well. So prehistoric field systems and then also being able to unpick, I mean, Kildare's the largest human-made forest in Western Europe. It's 100 years old, and everyone knows it today is for trees and coniferous plantations and recreation. That's the value we appoint to it. So we can sort of see that growth in the landscape that Stuart was picking out, but also all the things that happened prior to that. So farming before that, this medieval village, potentially a Romano-British phase that we're picking out, and then obviously some much earlier prehistoric bits and bobs as well. So As I say, Stuart's a fountain of knowledge. I'm looking forward to spending a day in the field with him and then going to the pub and letting him download to me.
It sounds absolutely wonderful. And I'm wondering, who else are you taking with you and how do you pick them? Who are the lucky people who are going?
The team this time round, obviously we've got Stuart for the landscape perspective, and that's going to be such an integral part of the narrative. It is a little site and we understand its context within this larger landscape of contention. We've got Hilda and Matt Williams coming, who are obviously very handy with a mattock. And then we've got myself, who will be getting my hands dirty as well. And we've got several other archaeologists from Forestry England joining us this time. Derek will be there. I don't know if I failed to mention him.
You haven't said Derek.
we're one and the same these days. If I say me, people think Derek anyway. Derek will be there, obviously doing a lot of the recording, some of the drone work, and also we'll be making him shift a bit of dirt also.
That'll be good for him. So it's people who are experienced in that nature of archaeology, people who know how to deal with remote stuff in forestry landscapes, as well as people who know how time team works and people who can do a hard day's work and talk about it at the same time.
Yeah, and obviously we'd want as many people as possible there, but the sort of practicalities of this site is very difficult. So in the past, we've had Emma doing metal detecting, but in this instance, we didn't feel metal detecting was quite the right process for the site. And obviously Naomi was there at Farley Moor with the standing stone doing environmental sampling. But I think with regards to the sheer access issues and the remoteness to this site, we'll be taking samples away and processing them in labs retrospectively.
Yes, and having worked in Northumberland with one of those sites where you've got to walk for nearly an hour carrying all your stuff, and then somebody says, "Oh, well, should we leave the shovels today, or do you think they might get nicked?" And somebody makes the decision that you're carrying them all the way back. It's there are drawbacks as well as advantages.
Well, I think it will depend how hard everyone works, whether I want them to carry their tools back or not.
Yeah.
Well, it is going to be tough, though, isn't it? And this is the thing about these expedition crew sites. They are in these remote, hard-to-get-to places where one of the other characters in the story that will inevitably come out of this dig will be the landscape.
Yeah, absolutely. And and that's the beauty of the X-Crew, I think. And it's much easier to deliver a project in a really challenging environment with a smaller team. Yes, we have fewer bodies and people to be able to shift dirt and do the work. But actually, in terms of the practicalities, we've got very specific site, a part of the site we want to investigate. We've got realistic targets and questions. So let's just take a neat little team, deliver the project and come away again.
So how, Lawrence, will we be able to follow your progress, and particularly Time Team members who I know are going to get really up close and personal with the archaeology you're doing?
It's a great question, Martin, because we are in the middle of nowhere. Connectivity is going to be an interesting one, and we're just trying to resolve that. Can we use some modern satellite technologies and connection and things like that? We are trying to pull out all the stops to have internet in the middle of nowhere, but we are certain that we will be recording daily diaries, which will be sent back once we're back at our camper vans and connected to Wi-Fi, and they will be going on Patreon for people to see what we're up to every day. And then we'll also be working with the social media team, so we're going to get lots of little bits and bobs that will go out more broadly to entice people over to Patreon, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that is it, isn't it? If you're a Time Team member, we are going to be bringing you to the heart of the dig as it happens. Best of luck with it, Lawrence. I hope it goes really, really well. I hope you manage to sort of, you know, the landscape doesn't beat you and the weather doesn't beat you, but that's what it's all about, isn't it? Going up against the elements to uncover something brand new and really, really exciting. I think the plan is that we're going to check back in with you when you're on site. You can kind of give us a little bit of an update as to how you're getting on.
We'll do our best. If we've got connection, we'll happily chat to you guys whenever.
Looking forward to it. If you want then the real inside scoop, as Lawrence has said, you do need to be a Time Team member. That will take you to the very heart of the dig as it happens.
Finally, on this episode, I want to give you an example of something I've been saying on this podcast for ages. So often we're contacted by people who are looking to get into archaeology as a second career, but are worried that they don't have the right experience. I tell them that the experience that they bring from other jobs or areas of life can offer a unique perspective and insight, and I think this is a really great example. A mathematician who works for a finance company has used his specialist knowledge of geometry to take a new look at a Neolithic burial chamber on Guernsey, one of the British Channel Islands just off the French coast.
Yes, this is Martin Dory, who's been investigating a 6,000-year-old burial chamber called Dehus Dolmen, which sits at the northern tip of the island. Now, light falls on the chamber in strange ways at certain times of the year, and Martin thought he'd use his geometry expertise to investigate.
And I'm very pleased to say that Martin joins us on the podcast now. Hello, Martin.
Hello, Helen and Martin. Hi.
Can I start by asking, how come you were investigating this burial chamber in the first place?
I'm writing a book on financial geometry. And what's really good is trying to understand the history behind how we ended up studying geometry. And it struck me that there was a very strong relationship between priests, temples, places, not just trying to understand the sky and the heavens, but also the development of mathematics and writing. And it's very well known that the Greeks had a relationship with mathematics, and also the Egyptians before them, and before them the Mesopotamians. And I really wanted to dig further, which is, well, what was happening with in the Atlantic seaboard and the people who built the megaliths? Was there an interest that they had in the sky and the geometry of the heavens? And that took me to look at the Dehu Dolmen, which I visited a lot as a kid. And when I saw it, it didn't really make much sense. So I thought I'd better think about it a bit harder. What were these people trying to say? So that's what took me in that direction.
Let's just talk about the site itself. I mean, can you explain a little bit more about, for people who haven't visited, what does it look like?
It's a round burial tomb. It's traditionally what you call a passage tomb, with a central chamber and a passage leading to the central chamber. But on the outside, it just looks like a grassy mound. And it's missed by most people on Guernsey who wouldn't even know it's there.
And inside it, it has this central pillar, doesn't it? And I know that you were particularly interested in the way that the light, when it comes through the door, hits this pillar. The shadow is then cast on the wall. And that was something that you were interested in looking at.
There's different recordings of what the orientation of the chamber is. One, which is, you know, in the sort of the public domain, and researchers have more accurately categorised the way it's facing. So the material for the Dehu Dolmen on various websites publishes it as being orientated with the winter solstice, that is, on a sort of a southeast direction. So I went down there on the 20th December expecting to see a very uncomplicated alignment with the inside of the dolmen and what was happening outside, but it didn't work. And I thought, well, this isn't quite right. So I turned off the lights and just let my eyes adjust to what was happening. In the dim light, there was a central shadow being cast by this pillar onto the back wall and across the floor of the dolmen. And so I measured it with my compass and it said, well, this is east-west. And I thought, that's interesting because no one's remarked on this before, because an east-west alignment with light coming in, that is normally associated with the equinox. Now, if you looked at Hugh B in Jersey, which is another passage burial tomb, that has light that comes in from the east and on the equinox and lights the sunstone. But this is like the opposite. It actually casts a shadow rather than sunlight.
It's fascinating, isn't it? It makes you wonder whether if somebody says something in print and nobody ever checks it, you know, what sorts of discoveries are there to be made? But I've also read stuff about this, the figure on the roof of the burial chamber, that is not just this central pillar, which is amazing enough, but also it's got this so-called guardian figure, which doesn't look to me like, I mean, we've gone through a bit of Neolithic rock art occasionally on the podcast and talked about things like cup and ring marks. This is a remarkable figure, isn't it, that's on the roof of the burial chamber. How does that tie in with it all?
I was trying to understand, okay, so we've got an equinox marker. Is there a relationship between this equinox marker and traditionally standing stones are said to be powerful female ancestors on the Western Atlantic seaboard in folklore. So how might this carving above it relate to it? And I thought, well, if the equinox is being marked, is there another astrological feature around 4000 BC when this monument was built? I program in MATLAB, so using MATLAB and Claude as sort of programming tools, I was able to roll the sky back to 4000 BC. What I found was that about 2 weeks before the equinox, there probably would have been grazing light illuminating the carving above this central pillar. Also, at 4000 BC, at the equinox, there was an alignment where Orion effectively falls behind the sun at the equinox in spring, and at the autumn equinox, Orion suddenly appears in the night sky again and travels through the winter night. There's this mathematics, which you can check and verify, which is the tomb itself, in its original form, probably received grazing light onto this carving about 2 weeks before the equinox. And then at the equinox, Orion disappears behind the sun. And I thought, well, that's interesting. That probably means something to the people who built this tomb. And then obviously there's an interpretation beyond that.
We do have a strong suspicion that Orion's got a particular significance in Neolithic society, don't we? Because the Thornborough henges are also thought to have something to do with Orion. I mean, I know it's very obvious to us now. It's amazing to think that those stars together also seem to have been important 6,000 years ago.
Yes. So the question is, what is the symbolism of Orion falling behind the sun and then appearing in the night sky? One of the things I've done is when I've looked at the carving, and Philip de Jersey did a very detailed study of the carving.
Philip de Jersey, ironically, is the Guernsey archaeologist, isn't he?
Yes, that's right. That's right. It's very easy to look at the carving saying we've got a face, we've got these objects here, we've got these objects here, and look at them in isolation. What I've posited is I've said there is another way of looking at this, which is they aren't independent, you know, hieroglyphs. They actually form a whole, and the whole is probably that of a human figure. In this case, I'm saying a description that fits the whole anthropomorph is that of a hunter. He's got a beard, he's got hair, he's got brow, eyes, he's also got a bow, he's got a throwing spear, he also has arrows on his back. But what's particularly interesting about it is that his bow is lowered and his throwing stick is down. Now, on that reading, Orion here would represent a returning hunter. And this is absolutely key, because in the winter equinox, Orion goes out hunting, and the traditional image of Orion is with his bow up. Here, he's a returning hunter because his weapons are down. This would agree with a folklore on origin stories that spring comes about because the light of the hunter of the sky joins with the sun to bring about spring. And that would be true in 4000 BC, but not now, not based on our sky. This is an interpretation, you know, above the hard evidence that would agree with the representation, the iconography that we're looking at.
And Martin, how do you go about then sort of checking this? Because your background is in finance. You're not an archaeologist or a historian. You are approaching this with your knowledge of geometry through your work. But once you've got this hypothesis, where do you go from there? I mean, who do you take it to kind of check you're on the right lines?
As someone who's not an archaeologist with zero archaeological experience, my new route for checking is basically research and reading papers. I've written a paper, I've called it The Guardian of the Paschal Moon, on the basis that this is probably a representation of the sky, because you've got a big round sunstone at the back. Then you have 12 stones, which traditionally would be symbols of the moon, and you've got this equinoctial reckoning, and you've also got this agreement with Orion and this anthropomorph on the roof of the chamber. So I think what I can do is I can say, look, this isn't just a group of stones. This is something that needs to be looked at more closely. I've written a paper. I've submitted it to Time and Mind. I recognise that there's only a 15% acceptance rate of these papers. But from my perspective, that's the best thing I can do to float the hypothesis and put it out there.
One of the things we ought to really keep in mind about Guernsey is that now we feel that it's part of Britain in a way, because it's that old fragment of the Duchy of Normandy, isn't it, that we in inverted commas got with the Norman conquest. But looking at this site, to me it looks quite kind of other, and I gather that you've got parallels in France much more than you've got parallels in England.
Yes, so you can look at, for example, that the presence of stone many years through history, and this is the research took me down to Portugal and Spain, And there seems to have been a movement with the Mediterranean Neolithic people moving around Spain, around Portugal, and then up into France. They seem to have brought a lot of their ideas about art with them when they reached Brittany. These people seem to have moved on to colonise the UK. So you talk about the Norman invasion. That's relatively modern history. But perhaps there was a Norman invasion before then, which is when these people would have used things like the Channel Islands to give them a paddling accelerated boost across the Channel, because we got huge tides. So there might be an economic motivation to stop by on Guernsey between colonising the UK.
So interesting. Martin, you've definitely done all your homework on this, and obviously this is something that really, really interests you. Are you inspired, do you think, to leave the finance world behind and become an archaeologist?
I think places like the Daehu Dolmen are going to raise questions after questions, and as science reveals new insights, there's going to be roles for people of all professions and all skills to go, aha, what about that? For example, a museum curator was at a talk I did to Guernsey Museums, and he said, well, I'd like to have a tour tomorrow. So I gave him a tour, and he looked at one of these stones, and he went, that might just be a natural pattern on the stones, but if a Polynesian sailor was looking at it, he'd go, this is a map showing currents. and I was fascinated, and it's that diversity of views, which is, I think, will help. And perhaps I can contribute just by offering a friendly ear. But my future is in finance and the mathematics of finance, of which this was, frankly, a procrastination that got a bit out of hand.
Well, I can't promise that we will read your book on financial geometry when it comes out, but it has been amazing talking to you, Martin. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. It's a real eye-opener.
Thank you, Helen. Thank you, Martin.
That's it then for this week. Next time, we are dedicating the episode to the enigmatic Tintagel Castle with its links to the legend of King Arthur. It is a brilliant episode, and I know you won't want to miss it.
As usual, there's plenty more for Time Team members on Patreon, including every episode of this podcast without the ads. Support our archaeology by becoming a member at patreon.com/timeteamofficial.
And we'll speak to you on next week's episode of the Time Team podcast.
Bye-bye.